三句之动四句就南无见之八度大尼者大吉金色吉贝斯南吉如拉宾吉三吉如巴吉三句之动四句就南无见之八度大尼者四吉大吉金色吉贝斯南吉如拉宾吉三界诸佛主，三界皆当随喜求南无阿弥陀佛，度他尼迦斯提，大吉金色揭谛，如来宾揭三界诸佛主。So having begun quietly. Remembering what His Holiness said today about the great importance of motivation, generating the correct motivation for receiving the teachings, which of course, as He reminded us, is that we should aspire to develop the qualities of an enlightened being in order to benefit all beings. So this of course is the bodhicitta. So last night we began to study Geshe Chekhova's text called 7 Points of Mind Training. And as I mentioned, the actual text of the 7 Points of Mind Training, or the root text, is very short and very concise. So that from the earliest times, when it was, it had to be taught in some detail. The meaning of the actual root instructions had to be explained very carefully by the early masters of the Kadampa tradition. So those oral explanations of the Lojong, of the 7 Points of Mind Training, then ended up written as commentaries. And so we're studying one particular commentary on the 7 Points of Mind Training, which is the commentary written in the 16th century by the 5th Shama Rinpoche, Shama Khyentse Yenlak. And so, we finished last night already the first point, which was the preliminaries, the general preliminaries that give us the kind of maturity and basis to be able to practice the main instructions. And those preliminaries were, as you remember, actually the so-called four thoughts or four reflections that turn the mind to Dharma, which of course the common preliminaries also for the Mahamudra Nundro in the Kajupa tradition. So we completed that. And then we began to study the second of the 7 points, which is actually the instruction for the main meditations of Lojong, of training the mind. And the way those instructions are presented in the root text and the commentaries is that we begin by training in the development of ultimate bodhicitta. Ultimate bodhicitta means the transcendental wisdom that recognizes reality as it truly is. So that right now we have a mistaken vision of the world. Our understanding of the world and the nature of mind is completely dominated by our ignorance and the habits that arise from ignorance. So we are far from transcendental wisdom, but we make a start on transforming our confusion into wisdom by training in the ultimate bodhicitta meditation. And that we studied last night. In Shama Rinpoche's instructions, Fifth Shama Rinpoche's instructions for that, he took us first through the way we begin a session, by taking refuge, of course, and generating the resolution to become a Buddha for the sake of others. If we are familiar with the Vajrayana, we can also add a Guru Yoga practice, and we can practice the seven branch prayer, which, as I explained last night, is a really wonderful way to purify negativities and accumulate merit. And in fact, this afternoon, of course, His Holiness was teaching the first limb of that in Shantideva's text, making offerings. So, we studied the beginning of the session, and then we studied the main part of the session for Ultimate Bodhicitta, which is meditating right on the relationship between external objects, what seem to be external objects, and the mind that perceives them. Because, as I mentioned last night, the basic way our ignorance about the world manifests is that we have a dualistic perception. We divide experience, we divide our experience of the world into true. As we believe there is a truly existent external world full of all kinds of objects, and we, our mind, is a separate perceiving subject. And that is that distinction that we make in ignorance between mind and appearances is where all the disturbing emotions of desire, hatred and ignorance and so on come from. So we have to heal that dualistic vision. And the way to do so is to meditate Ultimate Bodhicitta. Firstly by examining or analytical practice, actually asking ourselves the question in meditation, are there really such things as external objects when I experience the world? Or is it just that they're like images in a dream? They're just produced by my mind. And then when we understand that, we look into the mind itself to see, is there really a self in the mind? Or is it that the mind also is like space, empty of any intrinsic nature? And when we've done that analytical part of our meditation, we then settle in the openness and spaciousness that is opened up through the analysis. And as we rest in the basic or the fundamental nature of mind. And in this way, as Rinpoche teaches, we actually are practicing a kind of Mahamudra meditation. Mahamudra meditation right on the nature of mind. So that is where we reached last night. And we have just one little bit more to do on the Ultimate Bodhicitta, because in Rinpoche's commentary he divides it into the beginning of the session, the preliminaries, the main part, which we've just finished, and then how we conclude the session and how we take the understanding that we gain through that practice into everyday life. So now to pick up the commentary. Kunchi Yenla's commentary says, the third phase of training in Ultimate Bodhicitta is the post-meditation practice. All serious Dhamma practice has not just the instruction for meditation, but the instruction for how to take that into everyday life. Because otherwise, if we have some qualities developing in meditation, but then we forget the practice when we go back into everyday life, the force of our habits of disturbing emotions will quickly overwhelm any progress we've made. So it's really important that we have a way of integrating the practice with everyday life. So the instruction for that is found in Geshe Chekwa's root text in the next lines, where he says, between sessions, be someone who is in tune with illusion. And the meaning of this is that the emptiness that we've begun to see as the nature of all appearances and the nature of mind, we could lose that sense in everyday life, because whereas in meditation everything is rather still, not much is happening, in everyday life there's so many things happening. We meet all kinds of different people, we encounter all kinds of different situations, so it'd be easy to lose the sense of spaciousness and emptiness that we've gained in the meditation. So what to do? And here it is. Kuchiyang explains this. Once you've realized that all phenomena are inherently non-existent and illusion-like, be without any yearnings, desire, regarding food, clothing, home, friends, enemies, and so on. In other words, when we return to everyday life and we experience all these rapid changes, actually, what are we witnessing? We're just witnessing the play of interdependence, of dependent origination. That is still the same as emptiness. Just like when we see the reflection of the moon in the water, there's an appearance there. There's a distinct, clear appearance of the moon. But actually, if we went into the water and tried to grab the moon, it would disappear, of course, because it doesn't have any solidity. It doesn't have any intrinsic nature. It's just the coming together of a cloudless sky, the satellite of the earth up there in the sky, and a pool of water, and us being there to perceive it. The interaction, the play of these different things produces this illusion-like appearance. So everything we encounter in everyday life doesn't ever really depart from the emptiness that we've experienced in the main meditation. Everything is a play of illusion, or like a magical conjuring trick. So in that way, no matter how many things we encounter, no matter how busy our life is, we can be completely relaxed. It's only when we grasp at things as real and label them as pleasant or unpleasant that we get caught up in the habits of grasping or rejecting, liking and disliking. But if we remain kind of loose and open, because we appreciate how whatever we experience, whatever it seems like, actually it's got nothing solid about it at all. It is just the play of illusion, the play of produced by the combination of different factors coming together, like that image of the moon in the water. So whereas normally we are caught up in our reactions to different things like clothing, food, home, friends, enemies and so on, now we're not caught up. We don't fall under their spell. We realize they're just like illusions. So that is what is meant. Between sessions, be someone who is in tune with illusions. In that way, when we return to the meditation again in the next session, we can easily once again experience the fundamental nature of emptiness. So that is the final piece of the instruction for the ultimate bodhicitta meditation in Lojong. Now the second instruction for practice, which is now concerning the conventional bodhicitta. And as I explained last night, this means the development of love and compassion to its ultimate limit, to its final limit, which is where the resolution to become a Buddha for others arises, and where we exchange ourself for others. Because in the Lojong teaching, the heart of the conventional bodhicitta practice is that, to exchange oneself for others. The great master Shantideva, whose text His Holiness is teaching, says, those who quickly wish to achieve protection, that means enlightenment, for themselves and others, should practice the supreme secret, which is exchanging oneself for others. So, You know, this practice, which we're going to study now, of exchanging oneself for others, is like the secret practice of the Mahayana. It's the kind of quintessential practice of the Mahayana. Without it, Buddhahood is impossible, as Shantideva says. So, Kunchi Yena says, the second aspect of the second main point, training in bodhicitta, is training in relative or conventional bodhicitta, whichever term you prefer, during meditation and afterwards. And again, remember what we discussed last night, that it's very unusual to begin with ultimate bodhicitta meditation. Usually in the graduated path teachings of Mahayana, we start with conventional and proceed to ultimate. But the special emphasis of the Lojong is, if you practice some ultimate bodhicitta first, you create a space, a kind of openness, in which you can then really, so to speak, meet others directly with love and compassion, and so on. So, as for the main practice of conventional bodhicitta, the root text says, practice sending and taking alternately. So sending and taking, or in Tibetan, tonglen. This is the very special Lojong practice for exchanging oneself for another. But how to reach that? How to have such a... The question is like, how do we get such a brave heart, such a fearless heart, that we really can exchange ourselves for others, put ourselves entirely in another's shoes, and treat them like we've previously treated ourselves? How do we get to that courage and that bravery, that their sufferings become my suffering, and my happiness and virtue become theirs? The answer to that is, we need the catalyst, the kind of help that is provided by starting with loving kindness and compassion. So, Shama Kunchi Yenla says, love all living beings as your mother, and meditate with potent compassion on the suffering that they now experience. So, in the Mahayana, in fact in Dharma as a whole, we consider that all sentient beings have been our mother. Not just once, but innumerable times. Precisely because we cannot find any beginning to samsara. So there's no beginning to the stream of lives. And therefore, no matter that there are an infinite number of sentient beings, there's been more time than enough for all of them to have been one's mother. And not just once, but an infinite number of times. And because for most people, the mother is the person who has shown them the most care and selfless love in this life, the image of the mother is a good way to relate to other beings. Why? To begin with a sense of gratitude. Because love and compassion in Buddhism begin with gratitude for what others have done for us. And for most people, the mother is the most obvious one. But if it was difficult for you, you didn't know your mother or some problem, you could change this. It could be in your father. Or, in fact, any sentient being who has shown you in this life great, great care. Usually we do this meditation beginning with one single person, that is, the mother of this life, and then extend it gradually until we see all beings as being our mother. But here in the commentary, Kunchi Yenla kind of compacts it. So it's like, begin immediately by seeing all beings as your mother. And when we do see beings as our mother, we remember what our mothers have done for us. They conceived us in their womb. They nourished us in their womb. They gave birth to us with difficulty. They looked after us when we were helpless. They brought us up. They led us into the world. So it's not possible to pay back what we owe them. And with that sense of gratitude, we should think, may my mothers now have happiness. And not just happiness in the present, but happiness for the future. Which means, may they do good things now. Because as we discussed in talking about karma last night, there is a connection of dependency, of interdependence between virtuous acts and happiness. So we now think, may all sentient beings, my mothers, have happiness right now and practice good so that they'll have happiness continuing in the future. And then we should go further, reach a little deeper, and think, may all sentient beings, my mothers, be free from suffering, not just now, but in the future. In other words, may they avoid doing non-virtuous things, those selfish actions motivated by desire, hatred and ignorance. May they be free from that. So may all beings, my previous mothers, have happiness and the cause of happiness, and be free from suffering and the cause of suffering. In this way we generate loving kindness and compassion. And Rinpoche said, 47 Rinpoche said, the key to this feeling towards others is to think, how would I feel if I was in their shoes? He said this is the best way for generating loving kindness and compassion, to kind of make it that intimate. How would I be if I was in their shoes? If I was wanting happiness and wanting to avoid suffering. Now, we can go further. If we really want them to have happiness and freedom from suffering, we should consider it's our responsibility. We have the responsibility to make that come about. And so therefore, this idea that my happiness is something separate from them, and their suffering is something separate from me, that I have to let go of. I have to dissolve. So Kunchi Yangla says, imagine that whatever harms these mothers, all sentient beings, all torments of suffering and disturbing emotions that they have, enters your heart. In other words, you now take from them their present sufferings and the causes of their suffering, which are the disturbing emotions. Meditate that it all comes into you. Because after all, you have generated already the wish to become a Buddha for the benefit of others. You've dedicated yourself entirely to serving others, to freeing them from suffering. So how can you maintain the idea that what happens to them is their business and nothing to do with you? You have dedicated yourself to them. So you must now be willing to take their sufferings and the cause of their suffering onto you. Kunchi Yangla says, wish fervently for the joy of having this actually happen. It is, don't kind of be frightened, don't kind of be self-protective, but very joyously open your heart to take on all the difficulties of others. And then one should consider, and what can relieve the distress of our mothers? What can remove and replace this suffering that they have and the cause of suffering? They're helped by happiness and virtue. Therefore, we meditate that as all of our joy and goodness, or virtue, is absorbed by our mothers, they instantly become happy. All conditions for accomplishing the Dharma practice are complete and they're able to attain enlightenment. So this is the sending part of the practice. That instead of holding on to our happiness as a personal possession, we give it away. It's for them, it's not for me. And instead of holding on to whatever good I do, my virtue, I give it to them. So it becomes a cause for their future happiness. So I take their suffering and the cause of their suffering into me, and I send to them my happiness and my causes of happiness. And I feel that this happens. So I feel that they instantly absorb this and become happy. They absorb my happiness and my goodness. And it produces in them all the conditions for accomplishing Dharma practice, so that they will eventually come to achieve enlightenment. So in this way I accomplish the exchange of self for others. And what has made this very possible is that I already started, through the ultimate bodhicitta meditation, not to take seriously the labels of self and other. I've already loosened that tightness of thinking of myself as an entirely private, separate being, separate from others, separate from the rest of the world. And because I've done that, I can be open now. It's like the walls of between me and others, the walls that wall off and protect my happiness and virtue from the suffering and so on of others, they've begun to come down. Or to put it another way, like the ice walls between us have begun to melt because of my practice of the ultimate bodhicitta. And then to make this even easier, this practice of send and taking, the root text says, place these two on the breath. Place these two on the breath. And the two means the process of sending and taking. So in other words, link this with the breathing. Kunshi Yanla says, meditate that when you breathe in, the negativities and pain of beings, in other words, their non-virtues and their sufferings, and then the negativities and pain of beings dissolve into you. When you breathe out, your happiness and virtue are absorbed by beings. So, in other words, by linking it with the flow of the breath, you kind of make the practice less heady, less kind of intellectual, less conceptual, and more kind of from the heart. Because of course, as we saw last night, connecting practice, in that case it was shamatha, connecting practice with the breath makes it quite steady and less kind of agitated by thoughts. So linking the sending and taking with the breath makes it much easier and takes it deeper, as it were, takes it deeper into us. Now, Kunshi Yanla doesn't mention it in his commentary, but in other commentaries on the mind training, it says that we can also accompany this with a visualization, so that when we are breathing in the sufferings of others, we can imagine that their sufferings and their negativities, their disturbing emotions and so on, and their negative actions, it comes from them, kind of is drawn from their body in a form of a kind of black smoke or black pollution, and it comes in through our nostrils. And then it dissolves into light. As we breathe out, we can imagine that all our happiness and our goodness, our virtues, goes through our nostrils in the form of moon rays, or in some Lojong traditions, sun rays, whichever you like. And those moon rays touch beings, filling them with happiness and all the appropriate conditions for practice and enlightenment. So that is the exchange with breath and visualization. And all the time that we are doing the practice of this undertaking, Rinpoche stressed, we should retain this sense of spaciousness and kind of illusoriness, that the very notion of me giving anything to others or taking anything for others, even this is, these are just labels, self and other, so that we don't develop a kind of pride which would re-emphasize ourself as if we are so great for doing this. To, I'm so great. By the way, did you know? Right now, I'm taking your suffering from you. How great I really am. What a martyr. What a holy person. And as if that isn't enough, I'm also giving you my happiness. Well, I'm a swell character. So, again, it's drawing on the weak, the kind of loosening of these labels of self and other that the ultimate bodhicitta gave us. We have this kind of feeling of space and illusoriness while we're doing the practice. And so Rinpoche said that in that way we can see that we're gathering the two accumulations through this very practice. Merit, the accumulation of merit by the actual sending and taking, and also the accumulation of wisdom, because we don't grasp onto labels of self and other. So even this practice of conventional bodhicitta also has some part of the ultimate bodhicitta. It's both sides. Now sometimes people say this practice of sending taking is very fearsome, very maybe a little frightening. Maybe people think, well, perhaps I could cope with giving away a little bit of my happiness, not too much. Not too much, but a little bit. But, boy, I really don't feel like taking any more suffering on. It's just too much. I'll be poisoned. I'll be overwhelmed. I'll catch something bad from people. But actually, that is showing mistaken thinking. The great Master Sakyabandita, Manjushri himself, in human form, he explained the problem with this thinking. Because even in Tibet in the early days, there were some people who were objected to doing sending and taking, thinking that it would just increase suffering. But Sakyapandita's response to this, because it's very helpful to know. It is this. The fundamental cause of suffering, as Lord Buddha told us, is self-clinging and self-cherishing. If there is no self-clinging and self-cherishing in your mind, there is no cause of suffering in your mind. So in the moment of taking the sufferings of others, you are thinking only of them. You are not thinking of yourself. So actually, you cannot suffer through this practice. In fact, you can only be benefited through this practice. This is the great wonder and marvel of this practice. And that's why, as I said, to remind you of that, when you breathe in the sufferings and negativities of others, it dissolves like light inside you. In other words, there is no place it can lodge in you, because you have no self-clinging and self-cherishing attitude at that very moment. So with complete kind of confidence and openness, we can engage in this practice. And just to underline that point, the great Shantideva, whose work was studying with His Holiness, said, not only nirvana, but even the happiness in this world, all true happiness in this world, comes from exchanging yourself for others. If you think about it, we see that's true. The moments of real joy that we do have are always when we forget ourselves out of concern and love and affection for others. The suffering only starts up again when we start to think of, what about me? When we think just directly of others, we're happy, joyful and relaxed. So there's no need to be reserved or kind of fearful about the sending and taking. And that's why if doing the sending and taking is making you miserable, there's something going wrong with the practice. If that happens, then maybe stop for a while, think about what you're doing, and when you resume the practice, start by mainly emphasizing the sending part, the giving happiness. And then later this should kind of relax you, and you can then again take up the other side of the practice, the taking. So, that is the main practice of the conventional bodhicitta, the tonglen, the sending and taking. But there's another question now people might raise, which is, can I heal people through this practice? The answer is, yes, if you're a bodhisattva very high on the noble bhumis. But ordinary beings like ourselves, we cannot. If we want to help people be healed, we should pray to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. The noble Bodhisattvas and the Buddhas. They can do this. For us, this practice is a means of developing bodhicitta, maintaining our bodhicitta, and strengthening our bodhicitta, with the thought that through this practice, we will achieve finally the noble Bodhisattva levels and Buddhahood. And then we can directly help beings through this practice. But we do not have that power right now. That's very important, because this practice could be kind of misused by people who kind of imagine they have the powers to heal others. If you want to heal others, better pray to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas or take them to a qualified medical doctor. So then that's the main practice. Then the post-meditation advice for the conventional bodhicitta. Kunciyana says, as for the latter post-meditation, the root text says, three objects, three poisons, three roots of goodness. The root text of Lojong was very enigmatic, but this is one of the most enigmatic of all. Yusum duksum gesasum. Three objects, three poisons, three roots of goodness. What can it mean? So this is how Kunchu Yen explains this and how it can be the way to take the sending and taking into everyday life. He says this, a great many beings develop attachment, aversion and ignorance, or desire, hatred and ignorance, the three poisons, because they find objects to be either attractive, unappealing, or in between. Okay, let me unpack this. The first line, the first phrase in root text says three objects. In other words, usually we label everything we meet in life either as attractive, beautiful if you like, unattractive, ugly, or we're just in neutral. We're things that make us feel indifferent. So that's our habitual labeling the world. We're continually, it's like in a kind of stamping a label on everything that we experience. It's beautiful, it's ugly, or it's neutral. We do this labeling so quickly, we're so habituated to it, that immediately the three poisons keep arising. Whatever is beautiful, we have desire for. We want to grab, to appropriate. I want. And then whatever we feel is ugly, and that would include frightening and challenging as well, we feel a kind of hatred for. We want to destroy, to remove, to annihilate. And then that which we feel, which seems neutral to us, we have a kind of, we ignore the third poison. We don't look at. We're indifferent about. So that's how our life is. Labeling, reacting. Labeling, reacting. Three types of object, three types of poison. And so if we don't have a method of transforming this, then even though we may make very nice conventional bodhicitta meditation, the moment we leave the cushion, our mind is off again. I don't like that, I like that. I'm indifferent to that. And we're caught up in the flood of the disturbing emotions. And as Shantideva says, when mindfulness and clear comprehension go, the thieves that are the disturbing emotions steal away all the treasure of our merit. So we need a way of subverting this, of turning this around. And that's provided by the last phrase in this line, three roots of goodness. So what Shyamakuchikala says is, therefore imagine that once their three poisons have dissolved into you, they become endowed with the three roots of goodness, free from attachment, aversion and ignorance. Okay, let me unpack this a little bit. When I feel aggression arising to a person or a situation that I've labelled ugly or unpleasant, by noticing it through mindfulness, I can then turn it around. How? By thinking, may all the hatred that people are feeling now may be absorbed into my hatred. In other words, I take their hatred onto mine. Well, doesn't that make my hatred bigger? No. Because that very openness to others again cuts self-clinging. There's no self-clinging in my mind because I'm willing to do that. So, in fact, it's the very reverse. What started as hatred becomes virtue because I've used it to take away a cause of suffering from others. And similarly, with when desire arises for a beautiful object, I should meet it with mindfulness and think, may all the desire that others feel, may it come into my desire. And as may they be free of it, may they be free of the consequences of desire. I will take it into my desire. And it's like one's own desire is then blown up. It's flooded with the other's desire and blown up. So one is freed from the negative consequences. And instead of going on a downward path, labelling objects as beautiful, then with desire wanting to grab them, I'm now on the upward path because I've turned around. And what was a weakness for me becomes my strength. The weakness of desire, if I can connect it with this thought, may all the desire of others come into mine, becomes compassion, becomes sending and becomes taking the sufferings of others. So this is the way we turn even a bad situation into a good situation through the method of exchanging self for others. And then there's a couple of other lines from the root text for training between meditation sessions. So the next line in the root text says, use bywords, I prefer the word phrases for this, use bywords to train in every kind of activity. What Geshe Thakur meant by this is, it's very helpful if we kind of have concise reminders for ourselves of what we're trying to do. Like slogans of the mind training that remind us and kind of keep us connected with the practice in everyday life. If we can remind ourselves of these slogans, then we can continually return to the practice. So Shyamakuchikala says, for instance, recite, may all sentient beings, negativities and suffering mature in me, and may all of my happiness and goodness ripen in all sentient beings. See? It's a slogan, it's a sentence, it's an aspiration, and yet the whole of the sending and taking practice is contained in it. May all the sufferings and negativities of others come into me, may all my happiness and goodness go into them. So I should remember phrases like that. It's like a slogan to train one's own mind, so that one always remembers what it's like. You know, companies nowadays, I don't know in India, but in England there's been companies and universities and other places of great confusion have develop these things called mission statements. Usually the cheaper the institution, the higher the mission statement. But a mission statement is like, this is what we stand for. This is our aim in life. To cheat the customers, usually. But never mind. They don't say that. And so we need, like in Lojong, we need a mission statement. Here's our mission statement. May all the sufferings of, and negatives of others coming to me, may all my happiness and goodness go to them. If we remember that, we're practicing the mind training. And then a final line in this section of the text, kind of like for everyday life. The root text says, when taking, begin with yourself. When taking, begin with yourself. So Kunshi Yanlak explains, through accepting right now all the suffering that is supposed to be experienced in the future, may I also be able to relieve others of their pain. Let me explain it a little bit, because in the other commentaries it explains it in a bit more detail. One reason we may have difficulty with practicing sending and taking initially, or kind of reluctance, is that we may feel very weighed down by what we see as our own kind of collection of negativities. There may be things we've done which we feel are very mean and very low, and we feel kind of somewhat guilty or bad about these things, and therefore we think, well, I'm just too bad a person or too selfish a person to really have this courage and openness to do sending and taking. So, actually, there's a way to deal with that. Because who is this self who is too heavy and too weighed down with negativity? Oh, self. I can practice that also as another person. So, in other words, imagine that suffering that you think will ripen through your negativity. Imagine it affecting a future self, and then take it on. Take it into yourself. Remove it from that future self and give that future self happiness and the causes of happiness. And in that way, you kind of undo the heaviness of that deposit of guilt or bad feeling that you've brought with you. Because after all, as is being said in this teaching, self is another. So you can do that with your so-called future self. Take away the suffering that will ripen and they give in return happiness and virtue. So that is one way of strengthening yourself for this practice, by this beginning with yourself, as it says in the root text. So with that we conclude all the teaching for the session of conventional bodhicitta, the preparation, which is the same as the ultimate bodhicitta practice, and then the main part, which is the sending and taking, and then the advice for everyday life. So we've completed all of the second point of Lojong, the teachings on the main practice. So now we reach the third of the 7 points of Lojong. And that is titled, the third point is transforming adverse or negative circumstances into the path towards enlightenment. You see, there's a saying many of you probably heard, strong Dharma practice brings strong maras. We could say like strong interruptions. And often strong Dharma practice brings interruptions because it ripens more quickly than otherwise would be the case, negative karmas from our past. That's good that they ripen more quickly. Then we can deal with them and become free from them. But many people become discouraged when they've started Dharma practice and they're doing it sincerely, and yet troubles arise in their life. That is a kind of impatient attitude. But it's understandable if we don't have a way of dealing with the difficulties that can arise. So we need that. That's why the third point is how to turn whatever negativity comes into your life, how to turn it into the path to enlightenment. And there's not just how to bear it or deal with it, but make it something positive. And that is, points out a very important character of the Lojong. Usually we say that it's a characteristic of the Vajrayana that it can transform negativity into something positive. And that's true. But the Lojong also has this characteristic of being able to take bad situations and transform them into the very path to enlightenment. So this is what the third point is going to teach us, how to do this. So it begins with this line from the root text. When the whole world is filled with iniquity, which is a very nice biblical word, it reminds us that the actual word in Tibetan, digpa, means sin. When the whole world is filled with iniquity, if you want a more complicated word, transform adverse circumstances, negative circumstances, into the path of awakening. So when the whole world is filled with iniquity, transform adverse circumstances into the path of awakening. So, Shamakunji Anaka explains. When the karmic consequences of iniquity ripen, in other words, when the consequences of our non-virtuous actions done under motivation of desire, hatred and ignorance, when they ripen, the resources of the outer container means the world in which we live, the resources of the outer container, the world, degenerate. And its occupants, the beings who live in the world, that is, sentient beings, start to misbehave. So, in as the trouble in the world that we experience, both together, commonly affecting human beings, and also the types of difficulties that affect us individually, all of these are karmic. They're the result of non-virtuous actions. So we need, Kuchi Yala says, to integrate this situation into the path through both attitude, in other words, through changing our mindset, as His Holiness would say, change our mindset to these things, and through certain deeds. But the first one is, if we can change our perception of things, then we can go a long way to turning negative situations into the actual path. So we begin with that, changing attitudes. Because really it comes down to the fact, if suffering and the degeneration of the world and the sentient beings comes about through non-virtuous actions, they have at their root self-clinging and self-cherishing. So what we need to attack, to change, is not the world, not the outer conditions, or anything like that, or even the behavior of people, really, but the root of these things, which is self-clinging, self-cherishing. And where better to start than with the self-clinging, self-cherishing that is so dear to us, our very own. So we start here, with the oldest love story of all. Self-clinging and self-cherishing. So, to transform these attitudes, we begin by relying on conventional bodhicitta, drawing something from the conventional bodhicitta teachings as a remedy to self-clinging and self-cherishing when it comes up in our life. And then we will use ultimate bodhicitta. So, the first line from the root text now, how to train to transform negativity through conventional bodhicitta. Of all that is blameworthy, focus on one thing only. This is In the old days, so 40 years ago, when the Lojong's teachings were first translated, this is translated in the line, drive all blame into one. And this also was is probably the only line of the Lojong, which became the name of a poem by a beat poet, Allen Ginsberg, who was a Buddhist, of course. And so if you don't mind, I'm going to stick with the beats tonight, and we will translate this line as, drive all blame into one. Drive all blame into one. So, what does he mean? This is what Kunshi Yanlek says. If there is, I wonder who that one is that we're going to drive all the blame into. Who might that be? Kunshi Yanlek says, if there is no ego, I think we're getting there. If there is no ego, there is no cause for suffering. Once a self is clung to, English is a bit clumsy there. Once a self is clung to, many friends and enemies appear. Or jealousy towards superiors, condescension towards inferiors, and rivalry towards equals have arisen from this. And there it is. It's the self. The great Master Dhammakirti said, once there is self, there is other. And as soon as you cling to this body mind and say, this is me, this is myself, you are split from the world. And therefore you now look out and see something external to you. And what is challenging and frightening for your new sense of self is enemy. And that's how it begins. Where there is self-clinging, there are enemies. We're used to blaming all our misfortune on enemies. But where did the concept of enemy come from? It came from clinging to this and saying, this is, hier stehe ich, ich kann nicht anders. Here I am. Yes, you could see I was not a Protestant. Yes. Poor old Martin, we'll offer prayers for him sometime. And so, once the self is clung to, many friends and enemies appear. That's it. That is the one where all blame should be driven. Because we're always talking about get to the root cause. Politicians and other professional liars always say, get to the root cause of things. Well, the root cause of the suffering is, of course, this. The clinging to self. These manifestations are jealousy towards superiors. Because, of course, in separating myself off from the world, I don't find there's some parts of the world, some beings who seem to have more than me, maybe smarter than me, better looking, have more property than me. So I'm jealous of them automatically because I'm attached to this. There are others who I think are more or less the same as me, so I'm competitive with. And then there are others who I see as lower than me, so I'm condescending and contemptuous to them. And that more or less sums up my relationships with the world. Jealousy, competitiveness, and contempt. All self-cherishing and desire for pleasure have arisen from this. Because I'm grasping at this body and mind as a self, I see the world as something to pillage, something to loot, something to appropriate for myself. Once these have been generated, then they then give rise to every form of suffering. Because I'm battling with the world, the part of the world I see as my enemy, and I'm trying in vain to grab hold of the part of the world I see as what will support me. So I'm in conflict with the world. And that conflict with enemies and desirables produces suffering. Because I can never win. So Shama Kunji says, thus the sole origin of suffering is ego clinging. So nobody to blame. Not the external world, not other beings, but this clinging to self, this clinging to self and cherishing self. Now then, if there is no I, why do we reinforce this belief in a self over and over again? And as ultimately as we can understand through the meditation of Ultimate Bodhicitta, there is no I. I'm referring to a fiction whenever I refer to this. But I'm so used to it, so used to this way of thinking of the world, seeing things from the kind of this house through the windows of the senses and thinking this is really me, that it's a strong, strong habit. When self-clinging arises, recognize it as the enemy and get rid of it. So, as Akshantideva says, I need to kind of develop a grudge. The grudge I would have for an enemy because I blame him is an external enemy, is not the real enemy. The real enemy, the one who contrives my suffering, is self-clinging. Again, Shantideva says, if all the gods and demons rose up against me, they couldn't take me to hell. But I will go there led by my own ego. It is that will send me to direct me to hell. But if the ego is the great enemy, the good news is that, Shantideva says, an ordinary enemy, if you kick them out of your country, they just wait at the border and come back. But when you kick out the self-clinging, because it is just a fiction in your mind, it can never come back. It's gone forever. So we should have great kind of courage and kind of confidence through that fact. All that is needed to conquer this enemy is to change our mind. So that is what is meant by that line, drive all blame into one. But it is opposite to what we've been doing. Whenever any difficulty comes in our life, we immediately look for somebody to blame. And yet, it's not led us to any happiness. Whenever we try to conquer external enemies, we find, as Jasti Thome says in the 37 practices, many more arise in their place. So, the strategy we've had so far for dealing with difficulties and sufferings has been unsuccessful. It's time for plan B, which is to get rid of the self-clinging. Forget the external enemy, deal with that one. The self-clinging and self-cherishing. And then the root text says, cultivate deep gratitude towards everyone. Cultivate deep gratitude towards everyone. Which is like the kind of other side of this, driving all blame into one. Because just as much as we're habituated to blaming others for our misfortune, it's funny this, everything good in our life, we credit to ourselves. We're always ready to blame somebody else for everything that goes on. It's never my fault, I'm not the author of that. No, it must be you, you're responsible. But anything good, no, you're not responsible. I, all my own work, I did this all myself. I am really wonderful, I produced this happiness myself. Everything good I'm responsible for, everything bad that's happened to me, you're responsible for. So we got to dissolve that. First step is driving all blame into one. And now for the other side, cultivate deep gratitude towards everyone. This is how Shamakunchi Inlake explains it. Those who have attained Buddhahood actually did so by cultivating loving kindness, compassion, generosity, that's the perfection of giving, of course, and patience towards living beings or sentient beings. So let's think about that. There's no way to Buddhahood without these things. It follows that if there were no sentient beings, we could not attain enlightenment. Therefore, for us, there is no difference between the kindness of Buddhas and that of sentient beings. This is really amazing. Shantideva says this in Bodhicaryavatara, that when it comes to veneration, we should equally venerate sentient beings as Buddhas. We venerate Buddhas because we say they show us the way to enlightenment. And that's true, through their teachings they do. But we couldn't get to enlightenment without sentient beings. Because there is no enlightenment without bodhicitta. The very beginning of our path to Buddhahood begins when we have that thought, may I become a Buddha for others. Until that thought arises, we're not on the path to Buddhahood. Even if we're on some Dharma path, it is only Hinayana path. But when that thought arises, we're on the Mahayana path. But it couldn't be bodhicitta unless we saw sentient beings, and were moved by their difficulties, by their suffering. So there has to be sentient beings to whom we can respond, for our heart to open and this resolve to become a Buddha to actually happen. You see, like Lord Buddha himself, Shakyamuni Buddha, he said that the beginning of his path to enlightenment occurred in the following way. Once he was in one life, he was born in a kind of, I think, jewel merchant's family. I've forgotten a little bit now, but jewel merchant's family. And they used to go on the sea. They used to have to go on sea journeys to find jewels. So his mother, I think, she didn't want him to know what family he came from, because his father had died at sea, and so she prevented him from learning this. But gradually he found out that his mother had been lying about who his father was and what their kind of family business was and so on and so forth. So he became so angry with his mother that he kicked her in the head. And then as a result of that, when he died, he was born in the lowest hell. So not good, eh? That's not a good start. Not the place you think you're going to start. But when he was in hell, he was just, the demons in hell were just getting ready to strap him to one of the torture machines. One there where your head is kind of is cut in many, many pieces. Like a kind of salami slicer, I guess. But there's another guy already having his head kind of chopped into salami. And Lord Buddha, he's of course not Buddha at the time, sees this guy. And then the thought comes to him, I'll take his place. So he says to the demon, no, let him go free. I will take his place. And in that moment, the hell realm disappeared. And he's born in the higher realms. And that is the beginning. That is the beginning of Lord Buddha's career. Because at that moment, he exchanged self for others. He didn't become a Buddha, of course. He had then to train through 3 eons, accumulating merit and wisdom. But that moment of putting another before himself was the beginning. And so it is the same for all beings. The real Mahayana path begins when we respond to the suffering of another person. So without sentient beings, there can be no real development of Mahayana qualities. So therefore, for any progress we make in Dharma, we should be grateful to other beings, because they force us to do it. They inspire us to do it. And that even includes people who are difficult. They help us. So Shamakunji Anla says, especially consider that all those who cause harm are as benevolent as spiritual friends, in a Kadampa tradition, the usual word used for Lama was Gewishenim, which means spiritual friend. It's nowadays contracted to Geti. But originally it was what the Kadampas called their teachers. So, yes, the early Kadampas said this. The enemy, the difficult person, is your Geshe, is your spiritual friend. How can that be? I mean, it's one thing, you know, we see somebody who's suffering helplessly and we feel compassion for them, yes. But what about the difficult person, the bad person, the person who's giving us a hard time? Surely they're not. But yes, of course, think about it, they are. That's why Gishilang Ritampa says in the 8 verses of mind training, whenever I see a difficult person driven by sins and suffering, I will regard them as a treasure of jewels, so difficult to find. Meaning, because they can benefit me so much. And again it's said in the same text of Gishilang Ritampa, when somebody who I've cared for with a special care turns around and becomes my enemy, I should regard him as my supreme spiritual friend. Why? Surely this is the worst of all enemies. The person who's ungrateful, the person you've helped, looked after like a child, and then turns against you. Surely this can't be a helper. But it is. Because look, we say the Lama is our helper because he gives us refuge and initiations and lungs and teachings and so on and so forth, and they help us. But where does patience come from? The third of the six perfections upon which the higher perfections rest. Where does patience come from? Not our kind and holy Lama, he's so gentle. It comes from those who cause difficulties to us. When everything is gentle and soft in our life, that is one muscle, patience, that never develops. It is only through the encounter with difficulty that we learn to develop the strength of patience. And as Shantideva says, just as there is no disturbing emotion as destructive as hatred, there is no practice as powerful as patience, because it can overcome it. Because hatred can destroy everything good in your life, or in a whole series of lives. But patience is the one thing that can dissolve that hatred. So it follows, it must be an incredibly great practice. But no difficulties, no patience. So those who manifest in our lives as difficult, they are benefactors. They are kind to us. They are like teachers. Of course you can say, yeah, but he didn't mean to teach me. He wanted to harm me. Yes, yes. But thinking that way, what good does it do you? It doesn't do you any good. And besides, if you then get caught up in a cycle of resentment and retaliation, you only increase his or her hatred too. Whereas if you instead develop the gentleness and kind of elasticity of patience, your practice will not be destroyed. Your loving kindness and compassion will grow wider, because you can even accept harmful beings into that, and you have a good chance of turning them around as well from their self-destructive path. So patience is fantastically important, but we can't get it without difficult situations or difficult beings. So instead of wanting those beings to be destroyed or wanting them to disappear, we should, when they arise, welcome them and see how we can train with them. So therefore, even to them, gratitude is necessary. As Shamakunti Yenla says, to repay their beneficence, their kindness, even if unable to respond to injury by tangibly helping them, we bring about their benefit by means of wishes and words. So, okay, if you can't actually directly help the aggressor, at least you should have the wish in your mind, may they have happiness and cause of happiness and freedom from suffering and the cause of suffering. And then when you're very trained on the Bodhisattva path, maybe then you'll have the capacity to turn them around, just like Lord Buddha was able to do with Angulimala. Maybe if we met Angulimala now, and we were his potential 100th victim, maybe we should retire to a safe distance and make prayers for him. Whereas when Lord Buddha met him, he could turn him around directly. Until we're that strong, then prayers are in order whenever we meet an Angulimala. In brief, so Shamakunti and that continues. In brief, according to Langri Thampa, Geshe Langri Thampa was very famous early Kadampa master. As I said, he wrote this text called the 8 Verses of Mind Training. And it's actually Geshe Chekwa hearing that teaching of the 8 Verses of Mind Training that convinced him to look for the mind training teachings. Geshe Langri Thampa was abbot of a monastery in Penyo, just kind of north of Lhasa. And he had been a direct disciple of Potawa. Potawa was like second generation Kadampa master, just two generations away from Atisha. And Lamitampa is very famous in Tibet because of his 8 verses of Lojong, so beautiful, but also because he never smiled. Unlike Atisha, when Atisha went to Tibet, everybody was very struck by how this very learned scholar and master was always smiling. But Lamitampa never smiled. One day his disciples said to him, "Geshe La, why do you never smile?" He said, "There's just so much suffering in samsara." But they say that the only thing that ever made him smile was one day he was meditating in his cave, as you do, and meditating in his cave, and on his shrine he had a mandala, and he was making his mandalas with like precious stones. Anyway, he's sitting there meditating, and then he sees a little mouse come out of a hole in the cave and go up to the mandala and try to take off one of the jewels. But it's a great difficulty. So then the mouse goes back to its hole and makes a noise. And then another mouse comes out and they go together and take the jewel off the mandala. So that apparently is the only time Geshe Lamitampa smiled in his entire life. And then, anyway, out of his great compassion, he wrote the 8 verses of mind training. And then, later on, this young Kadampa practitioner, Chekawa Yeshi Doji, he was visiting one of his friends in a monastery, and they saw written down this verse, "Give all victory to others and take all defeat upon yourself." And he thought, this is very interesting, very striking, very amazing idea. So he asked his friend, "Well, where did you hear this? And where did you know what? Yeah, where did you hear this?" And his friend said, "Oh, this is part of the 8 verses of Geshe Lamitampa." So then Chekhova decided himself, he must find the master who wrote this. He must find Lamitampa and receive the teachings in detail from him. So he went to Penyul, to Geshe Lamitampa's monastery, but unfortunately it was too late. Geshe Lamitampa had passed away. And besides this, there's a dispute going on there about who should be the new abbot in the place of Lamitampa. And Cheka was very surprised. He thought, well, surely they should all be practicing this instruction of their master. Give victory to others, take defeat to yourself. In other words, how can there be an argument about who should be the successor when this is the teaching they must be practicing? But when he investigated more carefully, it turns out that there were 2 Geshes, both disciples of Lamitampa, Geshe Shangshumpa and Geshe Dodipa. And the argument was like this. One Geshe was saying to the other, "You should be the boss." And the other said, "No, you should be the boss." So this is a Kadampa succession problem. This is the old, by the way, just to make it clear, this is the old Kadampas. Okay? Well, this is how the Kadampa used to be. Anyway, so finally Chekawa met another disciple of Lamitampa called Geshe Sharwa, and then he received 8 verses. And then eventually he wrote his text, the 7 points. So the Shamabhijay continues, Shamakunjana continues about this gratitude. In brief, according to Geshe Lamitampa said, "Among all the many profound Dharma teachings that I have consulted and perused," does it really say that in the Tibetan? I think so. Okay, that I've looked at. I thought it was a little bit fancy. "That I've looked at, all faults are mine, all qualities belong to venerable sentient beings," is the key point. And as this is, for Geshe Lamitampa, this is like the highest of all, greatest of all teachings. The idea, whatever faults there are, they're in me. And just all qualities are in others. And Geshe-la says, this is the key point. Therefore, give victory to others and take defeat upon yourself. Other than this, there's nothing to understand. So, Shama Kujiyana says, you should practice according to this these lines. And this should be your attitude, that instead of, as we think, all qualities, I have all qualities and all faults are in others, I should reverse that. And instead see that I'm the one who has the faults. Take the, again, as the Ashwanian Tabas said in 8 verses, take the low place and give the high place to others. So see the qualities in others and see the faults in yourself. And therefore, whenever there's a kind of potential conflict, you give the victory to others and take defeat upon yourself. Why not? You're training the Bodhisattva path. You don't want anything for yourself. You don't want status or prestige for yourself. You let go of that because you want only the good of others. Therefore, whatever is good and positive, you give to others. Don't take anything or hold back anything for yourself. So with that attitude, you can give the victory to others and take defeat for yourself. This is the heart of the Lojong approach. And that is why it's so incredibly powerful, because it is directly opposite to our so strongly ingrained habits, which says all good is here, all bad is there. And as a result, see those as always as inferior and of no account, unless there's something to compete with or something to be jealous of. So victory to others and defeat to oneself. That's how we should practice. And in our Holy Lama, His Holiness, I don't need to tell you, because it is obvious that His Holiness is the true embodiment of this precept. He's really kind of a total living embodiment of this precept. So that is the conventional bodhicitta way to handle negative circumstances. And next we have to go on to the ultimate bodhicitta way, but we'll do that tomorrow. So why don't we sit for 3 or 4 minutes now before finishing. Lama Yandobo Yanchi gave us any interview. Telling Jam the Niji, Chanju to San Nipple, Chua, Sidu. So we're getting on with the text, and tomorrow I hope we'll be able to have some time for questions. First two nights, because we're trying to get quite a way into the text, there's not really been much time. But I hope that we'll reach a point tomorrow where we're going to have a few minutes space if there are any questions or clarifications. Okay, so I'll see you tomorrow. Okay.